Hello. In this podcast, we ask the question of whether, as a teacher, you'd continue the tradition of dropping solid metal sodium into a beaker of water as a demonstration, or which is a traditional thing handed down from teacher to teacher over generations, or would you stop and think and perhaps listen to what I have to say, counselling a bit of caution. And so I'm going to discuss that in detail and try and bring in some science into counselling you to take a more cautious approach if you ever consider doing this. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. I have to excuse myself at the moment because I'm a little bit congested. I may clear my throat a little bit. And you'll hear perhaps some raucous bird noises because there's local birds are having a territorial battle around here. Just stop, so it's nice and quiet. There's the old kookaburra and stuff like that. So the topic we're covering is if I've got sodium in oil, I take it out of my chemical container, cut it with a nice knife, it's nice and soft, get a nice big chunk, and I hold it above the water in this classroom there. Do I actually drop it in and continue the tradition where there's a nice big bang and flash and people are awe-inspired and inspired to do science, or do I think a little bit differently? Now, I'm going to be a little bit different. What I want to do is cover some background concepts. The first background concept I want to cover in general is the idea of a hand grenade. This is a handheld explosive that's obviously used in battle. And I'll, as this is Peter Hill Explains, I'm just going to go stream of consciousness and go right back. So Australians and hand grenades have got rather a mixed history because the first real first conflicts we were involved in was the Boer War, but after that we were involved in World War One, where we boarded boats, went around the Mediterranean under a British Navy escort and invaded Turkey. Yes, Australia invaded Turkey. We invaded north on the Straits of the Bosphorus on the north side, and there we encountered initially disorganised Turkish people, but they were well led by German officers, so I found out later by reading up. Eventually, this is called Gallipoli, we landed on the beach in impossible terrain with very poor intelligence and with great loss of life, we eventually withdrew. But where hand grenades go up there is that it was decided that Australians wouldn't be given hand grenades, and this is one area that you definitely close sort of trench, early, very trench warfare. I think it was 1814 or 1815, very early on. The Dardanelles. So this is, I've only read one or two articles or the odd occasional book where it sort of notes that Australians didn't get hand grenades, and we had to actually innovate and build our own little explosive devices. So that's the knowledge of hand grenades are sort of built into Australian history. And then we come across later on, I spent a reasonable time in the territorials or reserve army. I was doing different things, but occasionally I had to do standard infantry training. Part of standard infantry training is that you had to throw so many hand grenades to be qualified as a soldier. And so I'll just talk you through this so you get sort of an idea of how dangerous these things are. I still remember, I've forgotten the actual military name for them. They're an M something rather, because they're an American hand grenade, and it's like your classic hand grenade out of the movies. And now when I think of it, I don't think it had that pineapple shape. It was more a smooth shape, relatively small, wasn't too big to hold in your hand, but it was actually quite a nerve-wracking process, because there'd be a bunker which you'd all sit in. And you have hearing protection in these little foam wads you put in your ear. And as soon as you put them in, and you're a bit sweaty and it's a bit hot, you're in this bunker, and you can definitely hear yourself breathing. And you walk out, you get called out of this bunker, practice, and then the real. And there's this warrant officer. You go around a few corners. You know, this concrete sort of. I think it's actually raised up. What happens is that you inspect the hand grenade. You prepare to throw. Pull out the pin. And on the instructor's thing, throw. Of course, they're looking at you. They're not looking at where the hand grenade's going to go. Well, they might look up a little bit after you throw it to see where it goes. But you crouch. You know, you definitely, when you're inexperienced, you don't see. You know, you immediately crouch down. And the main thing that they're looking at is if you drop the hand grenade, because what they do is they actually pick you up by the shoulders. These are fairly beefy warrant officers, throw you out of the pit. I think you have to wear your webbing. Then they jump out afterwards. There's no, if you drop the hand grenade, there's no picking you up or doing anything. There's a process of getting out. So it's quite a dangerous thing. But I did used to throw. I got so nervous and so heavy, I didn't really throw it very far. I'm sure I only threw it 15 metres. So you have to really throw it 20 metres. I won't go on the ranges of it. Observing it from afar, it really doesn't look like anything. It just, you can hear a big crack and a bit fly up. If you're very lucky, you'll go underneath a log or something like that and throw it up. But in general, you see nothing. And this is one of the things that I want to sort of to talk about. These are small circular things, and they go off with a bang. And the thing with high explosives, this is a high explosive round or anything like that, they travel and they don't make much smoke. In fact, and a hand grenade doesn't make much smoke. I think the idea is that you want to use the hand grenade, but you don't want a big signpost, "Hey guys, I'm over here." And so a lot of the ordnance is smokeless, flash suppressant, and you can hear it, but you really can't see it. And so hand grenades, at night you can see a flash, and in terrorism you get a flash bang, which is a hand grenade, which is not supposedly to cause an acoustic shock rather than shrapnel, and a big flash to scare people. But in general, a bad explosive is a loud one. It's not necessarily very bright. You get and from this and from other things, you get a real sense of when something explodes, it's dangerous and it's got to have certain properties to be dangerous. So there's some combustible material, let's say a broken round or something like that. That's not necessarily explosive, but it's a certain configuration where the explosive is in the centre and there's casing around the outside, which is basically a bomb. That's dangerous. Whereas you can get some sort of plastic explosives and other things, and it will blow off in one direction and not cause all that much harm. It's got to be shaped and positioned. So what I'm doing here is painting you a picture in your head of this sodium I'm going to talk about and how it can be dangerous, like a hand grenade. So to try and break your reliance on the traditional people cutting up sodium and putting it in water, to warn you perhaps against it. And I've introduced into you, it with you, the idea of a hand grenade. And this is something which I didn't intend to do. I just had in the nature of my upbringing. I was, I suppose, more going for the money, the car, the small, the pitiful amount of money, the camaraderie, the free food. And that type of stuff, that was perhaps one of the least enjoyable things, throwing hand grenades. I really didn't like it. It seemed extremely risky sort of thing to do. I'll finish off with that. Now we're going to talk about the second part of our equation before we actually bring it together. We've got you the image of explosives and something dangerous in your head. Now I'm going to talk about sodium. So we've got, let me name the elements, hydrogen, helium, then the next row, that's the period one. Period two is lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon, sodium. So sodium's in group one. It's the leftmost. It's a soft white metal, and it has an electron configuration in old money, in the old Bohr Lewis dot orbitals of a central first shell of two electrons. The next shell is got eight up to helium, and then the third shell, it's got one. Now, in quantum mechanics terms, it's got the basic electron configuration of neon plus a 1s orbital on it. And so it's the ions are very stable, but the first electron in, that 2s1, let's see, 1s1, it's a 3s1. Let's go, yeah, it's from the third period. I'm just trying to really think through the, so lithium got a radial node, and sodium's got two radial nodes. So I'm just thinking through principal quantum number. The principal quantum number is the one plus the number of radial modes plus the number of angular modes, and the angular modes can be azimuthal, and in the azimuthal you've got the magnetic quantum number. That's if you're going through and no quantum mechanics is behind them. But essentially, sodium is a neon ion, neon plus an extra proton, and that extra proton is holding loosely at large distance an electron loosely, and that electron means that there's several properties. Let's talk about several properties. So the sodium, neutral sodium, the sodium ion is relatively small. It's smaller than a neon because there's an extra charge pulling it together, those electrons pulling it down. But the sodium ion is large, and sodium metal, each individual atom is quite large. And so your sodium metal, because of the crystal structure, is actually a silvery metal, and you can actually, it's soft, and you can cut it with a knife. Indeed, you just cut it through with a knife, and when you cut it, you'll see the silver luster, and within 10 seconds you'll see a white layer approach it as the sodium metal reacts with the oxygen. The oxygen and other materials, moisture in the atmosphere, reacts with it to form a oxide layer, and slows further reaction. But indeed, if you take it out of its oily baths, in an oily bath, I remember at university they used to have little worms of sodium, which was safer to have rather than these big massive chunks of dangerous sodium, and they would be in toluene, which is a nice sticky oil. I don't know, I think it's a paraffin wax, which is sort of a really icky thing to clean up. Toluene's a bit easier to clean up. And when you cut it, you see it there. And so we talked about sodium. It's a metal. It's soft. It's got very low density. It's got such a low density, it's got a density less than one. It will actually float on water. So if it's a metal which is lighter than water, so sodium will float on water. So I'm giving you all this information. I'm giving you the hand grade. I'm giving you sodium is low density. It's soft. You can cut it up. Now I want to talk about sodium light. So sodium is really, before we had lasers, that's what we called monochromatic light, because sodium has a S orbital. Yeah, I don't know why they're called D lines. It's an S to P transition. P is the shape of the orbital. P is, they've got a radial nodal line. So let's go through S, P, D, F, sharp, principal, diffuse, and fine lines. And so this is spectroscopically. You can look at a line and say it's one of these, identify it instantly. And from the SPD and F, you can actually tell the number of the quantum mechanical shape of the orbital. the actual shape of the electron coming in. So we've got a P to S transition. The S is the lowest transition. The P is the first excited state. And there's really no other excited states there. The P is a split state going down to a single energy level, a double energy level. It's spin orbit split. And so you get two energy levels. They're occupied a ratio of 2 to 1, so the intensity of light is 2 to 1 coming out of these split levels. And the wavelength, I don't have off the top of my head. Sodium is not something I really play around with, so I wouldn't know. But I do know that green is 550, yellow, which is the yellow, is around 580 nanometers. So it'll be around 580, 590 nanometers is the colour of these two sodium lines. So sodium has most of its light, most of its visible light is in two lines, sort of like 99% or 95% of all the light of sodium is in two lines. And it is in effect monochromatic. That is, it's one. It's used as a monochromatic source for interference. So Michelson, Morley, and a whole lot of people. Well, they wanted a monochromatic source. They just had a sodium lamp. You can have a sodium or a mercury lamp. Is another one which which produces one fairly strong line. So if you look at sodium, even through a kiddie's diffraction grating or a prism, if you shine a sodium light through a prism onto a wall, you'll see basically a rainbow effect due to the density of the gas. But you'll see these two bright lines, or one yellow line with a dark line in between it because of this spin orbit. Splitting the upper state is slightly shifted in energy. Now, off the top of my head, I can't quite imagine the exact energy mechanism between the spin of the electron and the angular momentum of the orbit or the associated magnetic field of an orbit. I won't try and describe too much of it. I think this is a podcast, we can get into it. The major thing is that sodium has a distinctive, rich yellow colour, and we are very fortunate as humans to have a green photoreceptor and a red photoreceptor, and when these are pretty well equally balanced, we see equal green and equal red, we say that's yellow. So we've just evolved to picking out this nuance of wavelength, and sodium's definitely on it. So in terms of spectrally, like, there's one spectral feature that you can see when sodium is excited or hot, it's yellow. Now, sodium is in sodium chloride, and this definitely dominates the flame colour. So if you get some salt and sprinkle it into your blue cooking flame, it will glow sodium yellow. So in general, salts have an abundance for a light abundance from the metal part of the salt. So it really doesn't really matter all that much what the what the actual negative ion is. It's the positive ion, the transitions in the positive ion, that produces most of the light in the salt. So if you want to see sodium lime at home, just get some salt and put it in a flame, it will go this brilliant yellow. In fact, even if you've got a small contamination of sodium salt, it will dominate any other colour. It's a really strong sodium colour, and there's sort of actually getting relatively rare in Australia to get sodium street lights. Again, I don't quite understand why they have the sodium street lights, why that is so. it's sort of quite interesting to see. So sometimes you get a streetlight, sodium yellow streetlights, and it's black and white or yellow and black because everything is this one colour. So that's sodium in the colour. And so we want to add those two things, sodium soft, relatively low melting point, it's got a yellow colour. And so now we go to the point of actually dropping it in the beaker. And for me, I sort of cast aside any sort of chortle. We've done this for years in Australian schools, and began to actually look at this. I suppose I looked at it from distance, at seeing other teachers do it. Now, what actually happens is, because if you put in a very small amount, it doesn't explode. It forms a little spherical nodule. And so what actually happens is that it reacts with the water, producing hydrogen. And when it initially does that, there's no source of spark or anything like that. And that rapid production of gas will hovercraft your little piece of sodium, and it will scoot around the surface of your water and producing heat. So the sodium will turn into a globule, a little molten ball. You can see this a little bit, and it will start to spin. I imagine that if it coats up with a bit of sodium hydroxide, that's the salt of when sodium goes with water, it forms sodium hydroxide. You can see it go into the water. If you put an indicator in the water, you can see the water become caustic. And basically, caustic soda, which is sodium hydroxide, builds on the surface. And I should imagine that if it builds up on the base, that is slightly lighter, and the top is slightly heavier, so it will start to rotate and form a shell casing around the outside. And if you have a small one of these, you can stop it and take it out and have an examination of it. And you have what is dangerous, and you really hope that when you take it out, you take it away. I wouldn't examine it for a while. Leave it for a while to make sure it's nice and dry, make sure it's not making any sound, because the last thing you don't want to do is to have it cook and then explode. And so what happens is you've got this, your sodium, a cube of sodium, melts and builds a shell casing around the outside, a quite hard shell casing. Now, depending on the heat and the inclusion of water pockets, that shell casing can be smooth, or it can have little craters in it as the sodium bursts out a little bit. A bit of that shell casing, i.e. it can actually be broken up, so it does form a shrapnel layer. And now, if you've got a bigger layer, and a bigger piece of sodium, say a centimetre by a centimetre, and you put it in the water or beyond that, it will bounce around, form the shell casing, and the shell casing will cease. It will reduce reaction for a brief moment, so it will go this hissing sound, go around silent for a moment, and then really heat up. I believe probably driving some steam around. So there's also steam coming off it. And then the sodium will become liquid and vaporise and form a sodium vapour in the air and burn directly in the air. And we know it's not hydrogen burning, because hydrogen burning has got this a distinctive blue flame. So you can see, as it's coming along, you can see a little bit of blue flame just before it goes, and this blue flame, the hydrogen burning, will ignite the sodium metal, and the sodium metal will burn. Now, people say metal burning, that's impossible. Well, indeed, metal does burn. Magnesium is an example of something burning, and magnesium burns, and sodium is more reactive, so it should burn more, but even aluminium burns, and we have this aluminium and metal burns, metal cladding, aluminium metal cladding in buildings. We know that burns. It's just the heat associated with it. Aluminium forms a solid sapphire-like layer of aluminium oxide, so it prevents it from burning normally. But there are ways that you can dissolve that layer and get it to burn quite vigorously. And in aluminium warships, the warship actually just begins to burn. The actual metal begins to burn. It's nice and maneuverable, nice and light, but it can actually burn another material which burns, and it's equivalent to a group 3 metal, so it's a bit more like magnesium, but it'll burn, and that is uranium. Uranium burns quite vigorously in air, it's an amazing thing to see that going. But when this sodium does explode, you see this characteristic yellow flash. And the yellow flash says it's sodium burning. So regardless of what people write on the board with sodium plus water gives hydrogen, oxygen, it is sodium plus oxygen goes to sodium oxide and forms a fume. And that is a small particles. And we know the relative size. If there were only a few, and they're more than a couple of wavelengths of light across, because it's white, a thick, heavy white smoke then goes across. And this smoke is a very caustic, dangerous smoke. So what I'm hoping to do is give you some feeling of the danger of hand grenades, some logic of what the sodium's doing, some understanding of the sodium as a metal, being low density, low melting point, and things like that has a distinctive colour, so that one can make observations and understand this. So the answer to this is be very cautious and think twice before undertaking or being even advised to do this experiment at school. I would do it basically with a robot remotely, with cameras at a distance to do it safely, or do a YouTube of it. I suppose there's the very interesting, I've forgotten what it's called, British series. Oh, I've forgotten the name of it. It's from the Dig. I've really forgotten what the actual name of the series, and they show a series of explosions in bathtubs, and it's obviously been faked, the whole lot of it, but it's very interesting. Yeah, it's under group 1 metals. It will come to me at the moment I stop doing this podcast, and that is a good point to say it's time to do the stop doing this podcast. The aim of this podcast for me is to actually just talk about a topic and bring get my conclusion of saying be cautious, but talk about it in such a way that the information is given to you and it's woven together to give you an understanding of what you're doing, and to talk science through what might be a more political thing of people egging you on to do this experiment. So please be cautious, and think about it, and think about the science that you, or think science before you actually go off and do something like that. Thanks a lot for listening, and happy and safe science in the future. Thanks for listening.